Welcome to this episode of My Journey as a Physicist. Each episode features an interview with a physicist to learn about their work, their interests outside of physics, and their professional journey of how they ended up where they are today. Season 3 features physicists involved in the long-range plan for nuclear science. I hope you enjoyed today's episode.
Welcome, everyone. I'm Bill Good, and I'm here with Kinza again.
Hi, everyone. We are happy to have Philomena here with us today. Thank you for joining us. To get started, could you introduce yourself?
Yes, I am Philomena Nunes. I'm a professor in physics and astronomy at Michigan State University and also at the Facility for Isotope Beams. I'm a theorist. I am a nuclear physicist. That's from my job perspective. I'm a professor. I'm a mom. And I really enjoy interacting with people and nature in general. So that's a little bit about myself.
Now, can you give us some ideas of what your research is about?
Okay, so I'm a nuclear theorist, and my research is really focused on understanding reactions, in particular with rare isotopes. Now, rare isotopes are these sorts of nuclei that are very unstable. And so that one of the main ways in which we can learn their properties is through reactions. And so I'm that person that will model these reactions and try and understand what's going on.
Maybe for the more experienced audience, could you go into even a little more detail about like what kind of reaction theory looks like?
Yes, the sorts of reactions I'm interested in are the reactions in which only a few degrees of freedom play a role. And so you really are solving like a Schrodinger equation for scattering, for the continuum. And it depends what is going on in the system, whether the system is going to break up, whether the system is just going to transfer parts of its mass, whether the system is going to fuse. So several things can happen. And the theory tries to capture that in the formalism. But it's basically quantum mechanics in its all glory.
Yeah, I did some nuclear structure research that also touched in some nuclear reactions. And I'm like, wow, this is actually pretty understandable when I was an undergrad and had done quantum mechanics and everything. Part of it is just solve the Schrodinger equation, and I think that's pretty cool.
Exactly. That's what I tell people when they ask me, what do you do for a living? I solve the Schrodinger equation.
Could you go into detail about what your day-to-day is typically like? I've heard it's usually not a standard set thing for most professors, but if you could sum it up.
Yeah, it's not a standard thing at all. Like, you know, like today is a teaching day. So I started my day just looking at preparing for class and doing, you know, actually teaching. And then after teaching, had a bunch of meetings. And so I was involved in meetings all day. But typically, I also meet with my students, my graduate students. I might be working on a paper. So I might be also working on the graphics for the paper or things like that. I might be reading. I might have to catch up with some reading. So it's quite diverse. And sometimes it also involves reaching out to collaborators if there are aspects of a given project that I need expertise that we don't have.
Yeah, that sounds really interesting and like a full day. Yeah.
It's very diverse. And no day looks alike.
Yeah, I like that you mentioned you work on the graphics for your papers a lot. I've experienced a lot of that already.
Yeah, sometimes, you know, a picture captures much more than pages of text. And so having a good way of presenting your results is really key.
Yeah, that sounds very interesting. So moving on, how would you explain to undergraduate or first year graduate students what your roles are in the long range plan?
So the long range plan, I guess you've already had some podcasts with people from the long range plan. But it's just in a snapshot, if people haven't heard those, it's a way of organizing the scientific community and finding priorities for the field that then are taken quite seriously by the funding agencies. So I am a member of the Long Range Plan Writing Group. So there are these various stages in the Long Range Plan effort. And ultimately, there is a group of about 60 people that get to write the Long Range Plan. And I am part of that committee. Within that, we are organized by subcommittees. I'm involved in three of those. One of them I'm chairing, which is the theory subcommittee. The other two are workforce and development and the nuclear structure and reactions scientific part. So yeah, I'm quite up to my neck in things long-range plan related.
Did you go into detail about what are some of the like big important things from the subcommittees you're involved in, and specifically on the theory side, since that's what you're working on?
So I think when we're going through this process, I'll keep it rather general because, you know, I'm not supposed to be talking about all the discussions in detail that we're having. But typically what we try to do is look back at the last period since the last long range plan, analyze what were the accomplishments, what did we say we were going to do, what did we actually manage to do, and then look into the future and what do we think we are going to accomplish in the next period, what are we going to set ourselves to do for the next period. And so it's quite an interesting exercise because it's sort of reflection and at the same time vision into the future. I mean, particularly if we think that things have gone wrong somehow, right? There's something that wasn't quite right and that we need to correct paths. This is a very interesting way of doing it because the whole community is coming together and discussing about it. If we think there's an opportunity now that there wasn't there, you know, 7 years ago, then we try to harness that and get it on the books. So it's a lot of back and forth in the discussions, and it makes it for a pretty wide scope kind of exercise.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I don't think I'd actually heard people consider if we screwed something up in the past, you know, how can we fix that?
Or if we said we were going to do something and then we didn't think, well, actually, perhaps we want to reframe that, right? Because perhaps what we were thinking has changed and then we think about it differently. Or then just new opportunities arose. And so we can do something completely different than what we said we were going to do. So typically, we do follow the long-range plan pretty closely as a community. So it's not the big stuff that we would reorient. But there are things in theory that we might say, okay, this didn't have as much emphasis before. We're going to give it emphasis now because we think it's really important.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Can you say anything about whether there's been discussions of things like that we're having to rethink for this next decade or so?
So in this cycle, it's clear that the machine learning, artificial intelligence, quantum computing, quantum information science, you know, all these things have come front and center in ways that were not there in 2015 in the last long-range plan. So that's one example of something that we are considering much more in depth. Also, we got a charge that included workforce development and diversity, equity, and inclusion in a way that is sort of weaved into the whole long-range plan. So that's also different. We're taking a look at that with different eyes this time. So these are two examples of things that we're looking at in a different light than we did in 2015.
Absolutely. Yeah. I think obviously the latter is something very important that, you know, we should have been focusing on for a long time, but I'm glad we're getting it now. Are you having any part in diversity, equity, inclusion, and workforce development?
Yeah, so I have to say this comes up in all the subcommittees I've participated. So, of course, one of them is focused on this, so that's all they discuss. But even the other two subcommittees, we are talking about it quite a lot. I have a real concern for creating a environment in nuclear science that is welcoming for all. So I really, really have a strong push in this direction. And I'm really hoping that our long-range plan will come up with good initiatives that can promote this.
Definitely, I totally agree.
Yeah, no, I think that's very important. And I'm so glad that the physicists are looking in this direction. They're working on diversity and inclusiveness for all. So moving on, when and how did you decide to become a physicist?
How did I decide to become a physicist? Well, it was sort of a gradual thing. So my parents are not scientists. My parents were not in anything related to science. When I was in ninth grade, I had a physics course. And I remember picking up the books for that year and just looking at the physics book and just devoured the book. I just gobbled up the whole thing in one go. So it was very clear that all those questions that were hovering in my head that my parents couldn't answer, there was a way to get the answers in this book. Somehow I started to see some of the things that because I had all sorts of whys, like, you know, why is the cloud not falling? Why is, you know, these sorts of silly questions that you ask as a kid. So I knew that physics was really interesting to me because of the way I reacted immediately when I had that first course. But I didn't imagine that I would become a theoretical physicist. I actually thought I would become an engineer, and I followed some engineering route. And then it just, through the practice, it became very, very clear that I was way more interested in equations than I was in actually doing experimental work. And so by the end of my engineering degree, I was just completely a physicist and completely a theorist. So that became clear. So my PhD was in theory.
That's so interesting. I had a follow-up question. You also said that you're a nuclear physicist. So what sparked your interest in that area?
Yeah, just the other day, I was talking to students about this, that I could have really ended up in atomic or molecular. I could have ended up in multiple fields, because what really, I really fell in love with quantum mechanics as a theory, right? And so there are many systems that fall under the umbrella of quantum mechanics. And it just happened that there were opportunities in nuclear reactions. So I had undergraduate research in nuclear reactions, and one thing led to the next and to the next, and suddenly I'm a nuclear theorist. So I don't think it's just because I'm only interested in the nuclear problem. I think I'm actually interested in multiple problems and in multiple scales, but there's some serendipity in the area in which you end up, right? It's, you meet the right person, there's the right opportunity, and suddenly you're working in this problem, you find it interesting. It's quantum mechanics nonetheless, and so just progress. But there are great problems to be solved in nuclear physics. So I think it will keep me busy for the rest of my life.
Yeah, I'm just starting my research work as a grad student, and I'm like, I'm going to be busy for the rest of my life. I totally agree.
Exactly. I don't think we're going to run out of nuclear reaction problems for quite some time. So it's mm-hmm. I'm going to continue at it.
I found it very interesting that you mentioned specifically that you kind of had a moment with a physics textbook
mm-hmm.
saying, like, I'm going to be, you know, at least, I know you started in engineering, you want to do something more practical, but started with this field of physics area, which it's a different path for everyone.
Yeah. So you said that there are so many problems in nuclear physics. Is there anything in particular that you're specifically interested about or interested in solving, or something that just excites you?
Yeah, so one of the things that at the moment is really sparking my interest, and I haven't really been working on it, but I am starting to try to redirect effort in that direction, is this prediction by nuclear structure theory that there is an island of stability in the super heavy elements. So I don't know if you guys have heard about this, but for quite some time now, a vast array of models predict that there are elements, super heavy elements, elements that we haven't seen ever, right? That are much heavier than lead or uranium, and that we should be able to get to them, you know, and actually use them perhaps for some purpose. So the problem is, how do you get there? You know, you have to manufacture this. The only way that seems sensible is that you throw this nucleus onto some other nucleus, and through some sort of reaction, you end up generating these isotopes. And so that's a line of research I'm starting to get super excited about, and I want to work more on. But the sorts of problems that I've been working on have mostly been related to nuclear astrophysics. And so very often you can't actually measure the nuclear astrophysics reaction of interest because the rates are too small to be measured in a laboratory, or it's just impossible practically to do it. And so I've worked a lot with nuclear astrophysicists to come up with reactions that can be used, that can get at the same information. And so, you know, I've worked on things that connect to the solar neutrino puzzle. I'm sure if you've heard about this, you know, in the 90s, we were getting so little neutrinos in the detectors here on Earth. And it turns out that the answer was really not provided by nuclear physics. The answer was provided by neutrino oscillations. But at the time, we didn't know. And so we were trying to fish into that. I've also been working on halo nuclei, these types of nuclei that are super exotic in that they have like a core and then there's neutrons hanging around like in a halo. So it's a very exotic structure. So I've done a lot of work in relation to that. So anyway, those are some of the type of phenomena, intriguing phenomena that we grapple with.
Now that sounds super interesting. I can't wait to learn more about these things.
I actually had a question. And I know we're swerving back into research, which is fine. I like to hear about it. So I have heard about this island of stability that has really heavy isotopes. I guess my question is, what order of magnitude of lifetimes are we talking about in stability?
There is quite a variability in the various models. And so they are already seeing that some isotopes, as you start to move up the ladder of mass, some isotopes increase the lifetime. But all the isotopes that have been produced, the super heavy isotopes that have been produced, have only lived a small amounts of time, like well below a second, right? So they're not long lived yet. I think it is hard for us to say for sure how long lived these things are going to be, because as I said, the models are not precise. There's some variability. There's a lot of parameter dependence and there's some variability. But what is unequivocal is that there's somewhat island of stability. And so going out there and trying to search for it and trying to find the properties will answer your question. Are we talking months? Are we talking years? Or are we just talking days? Right? And I don't know the answer to that question.
It's really interesting. Yeah. I hadn't thought about that question before and I asked it, and I guess, yeah, it makes sense. There's no answer right now, but that just clicked with me how exciting this is.
Yeah. I mean, we could find something out there that actually could be used for something. We just don't know because we haven't produced it.
Absolutely.
Okay. So the next question is, what obstacles, if any, did you face along your way of becoming a physicist?
I think everyone faces obstacles, right? This is part of life in general. You know, life throws at you all sorts of things and you just deal with it. And I think there are things that are specific to women in science that deserve to be mentioned. I think we should mention them. So certainly I have learned to coexist with my male colleagues, but I have missed tremendously the interaction with women in my workplace. So I've tried very hard to build networks that include women so that I can sort of complement that. But at the end of the day, you spend such a large amount of time at your workplace that it can be a less inclusive experience just by the sheer fact that we don't share necessarily the same interests as the people that surround us. So that's one aspect that is perhaps subtle and not talked about so much, because it's usually the sort of discrimination, big words that are talked about. But I think there is a cumulative effect that is experienced by minority groups in environments in which they're not well represented, that is your own culture is kind of gone, right? You want to go knitting. You want to hang out with some people to go to knit and share some knitting things. And there's really nobody that you can do that with in your environment. Or that's just a silly example, but it's that sort of thing, right? You want to go for lunch with people, but all people are discussing is about the last football match and you really have no interest in that. So that can create an invisible, I would call that sort of an invisible but very impactful obstacle to feeling like this is the place where I want to be. And so I don't know, perhaps you want to ask me about other things, but that's what comes to mind.
Yeah, that's very interesting. I never, like, obviously I've heard about, you know, that physics is like a field that's not specifically well represented, like women are not well represented in that field, but I never really thought about it this way. Do you think that the workplace or the work culture is changing and women are being represented gradually, like more as compared to before? Do you think it's getting better in any way?
So clearly, if we have a larger representation, then the problem that this obstacle that I mentioned kind of goes away, right? Because just by the fact that you've got a larger diversity of interests, and then you're going to find people that share your own interests. But the statistics actually show that we're completely flat. The number of women in physics is just not changing. the percentage of women in physics is not changing over the last decade or something. It's not changing. So the answer to your question is we can continue to make efforts, but currently overall numbers do not show that there's been that much progress. We're stuck at about 20%.
That's very sad to hear. Yeah. And I wanted to, you know, put in my perspective with my obvious identities, but yeah, it took me a really long time to really click, and I can't fully understand it, but I've started to realize like how disparaging it can be to have no one like you around in the field. And I want to say I see that, and I hope more of the men in the field can really hope to understand that and see that as a reason to keep pushing these initiatives and hopefully actually get something done about that stuck at 20%, you know?
Yeah. And I mean, in comparison, there's still 20%. Like in my case, when I joined, for example, Michigan State, the group here, I was the first woman to join the laboratory as a sort of regular academic faculty. And so it was very common for me to be the only woman in the room. It was very common. And so I really sympathize with my Black colleagues that are in that role now, right? I mean, we have more than one woman in this laboratory now. We have several, but we have one Black physicist in the laboratory here. And I really, really do feel like it's similar. He's going through the same things, let's say. It's just a different identity, but it's similar.
Definitely. I guess now is as good a time as ever to mention that I think there, as a grad student, I've started participating in some of the student organizations, and there is a National Society of Black Physicists, and I encourage those listening to look into that. And if you can, you know, try and start a chapter of your own. I'm not a part of this, of course, but MSU just started their chapter of NSBP like last year. So, and we had the president come speak like last week, the president of the NSBP nationally. So I'm just trying to help here by encouraging that.
I actually do have a follow-up question. What do you think that we as physicists can do to encourage more diversity in this field, like encourage the students or the high school students or young women to come into this field? Are there any initiatives that we can take? Or
there are so many. It's just, you know, it doesn't end. You can do so much. I mean, every single person can do so much. We need to get the message to the youngsters, right? We need to get science in the minds and hearts of those youngsters that are still in middle school and are still trying to ponder what they want to be when they grow up. We also have a lot to do in retaining, right? Once we do recruit, making sure that these people feel welcome, that these people are treated equitably, you know. That often means doing something that some physicists feel uncomfortable about, and that is self-reflection about our own actions, right? Because we all have biases. We all have been formatted by our cultures and the society surrounding us. And so in many ways, we can contribute to the problem instead of being a helping hand. So I think there is no end to what you can do. It's just how much do you want to do?
Thank you. I think that's very interesting, because usually when I hear people talk about this, I hear how can we promote other people of different groups to enter this field, but I never really hear discussions on how we can retain those people in this field and make a difference within this field to help them. Okay.
I wanted to ask one more question about the obstacles that you overcame. You said you are a mother. I was wondering if you wanted to talk about how that is and how it is being a mother as a physicist.
Well, being a mother, you get to guide or help this human being grow and become their own person and just go out in the world and do wonderful things. So being a mother is wonderful. Is it always easy to be in academia, be a professor and try to do your research, run your group, do all the service, do all the teaching and be a mother? No, it's not always easy, of course. And I think if anyone tells you it is easy, probably lying. It's super hard. It's super hard. But is it worth it? Absolutely. Absolutely.
Thank you for sharing that. Yeah, I just wanted to promote that. You said that earlier and make sure to put it out there. And yeah, I don't think I've ever heard someone saying it's easy to be a mother, let alone a parent, as a academic. So
what do you do to relax? Do you have a special hobby or something that you do when you're not doing research?
Yeah, so I do really try to keep some balance. So I'm going to share something. I suffer from chronic migraines, and it turns out that if I don't keep a reasonable balance, it just goes completely out of whack. And then I just cannot work because this is very debilitating. So it's really not a choice for me. It's a matter of my health. And so I really try very hard to keep a balance. And I am an avid yogi. I do a lot of yoga. I really enjoy reading literature and, you know, not just fiction and nonfiction, but also poetry. I really enjoy poetry a lot. I enjoy writing. I enjoy walking. I enjoy if I get a chance to go to the beach and just swim and be in the sun, I just do that. So yeah, I enjoy lots of things. And I think it is a disservice actually to the physicist profession when people present things as you can't do anything but work, right? I don't think that's true. And I don't think that actually needs to be true for anybody, because we all humans and we all got all these interests, and it's good to be well-rounded. The person you bring to work is a happier person when you're well-rounded.
I absolutely agree. The conference that I was at this week, there was a plenary talk actually relating to workforce development and everything within that field. And one part of that was we need to make it a better environment in general for people to have a better work-life balance. So yeah, I'm glad to see that it can be done, but yeah, I think it needs to be improved upon. And one other addition was I was interested to hear that you suffer from chronic migraines. My mom actually suffers from those as well. And I have them sometimes. I'm hoping it doesn't increase in frequency, but that is debilitating some days. And I'm looking for a word and I completely lost it, but I'm glad to see that you can get through it and that you're doing great. All right. In that case, I'll also add some speed round questions. What's your favorite book, if you can name one? And what's your favorite poem or poet, maybe?
Oh, my goodness. I did not come prepared for that. I like quite a lot of books. This is a hard thing. I really didn't expect this. The way I'm thinking, so you can totally see I'm a theorist. I'm going through the classifications. Am I going to say a Portuguese author? Am I going to say a US author? Am I going to say a Latin American author? Am I going to say an African author? So there's all these categories and I don't even know where to start. Okay, let's stick it with the US. Whitman. Okay, Whitman. I love Whitman. I think he's a great poet. It's a very positive, very energetic, very forward-thinking kind of poetry, and I love it. I think Walt Whitman is perhaps the one that comes to mind within the U.S. of poetry.
That's good to know. I'll look more into that. I like poetry myself, but it's hard for me to convince myself to sit down and read some, you know.
But there's plenty of contemporaries as well. But I'm just going to mention that there's a podcast called The Slowdown that is just a poem a day. And they all contemporary. And it's really a delight. You know, it's 5 minutes and it's like savoring a little chocolate every day.
Yeah, I'm familiar with that podcast because I used to write poetry in high school and I am also really interested in that. And I used to listen to that podcast. And yeah, I agree, it's very refreshing.
But truly, poetry sometimes is the only way that you can express something. Obviously, you know, now this is a parenthesis. You're MSU students, right? You know what we went through. We went through a horrible shooting here. And that's what came to me also. I mean, a poem just came to me because when you've got such intense emotions, it seems like it's the right way of just putting it out for me. I mean, perhaps painters would just paint something, but for me, it's really poetry.
Absolutely. This is taking kind of an interesting turn, but yeah, I agree.
Okay, to sum up, do you have any advice for young physicists or young researchers?
Yeah, actually, I have so much advice that I even developed a course. But there was so much stuff that I wish someone would have told me this, that I developed a course that's called Tools for Women in STEM. I would say, okay, for the purpose of this podcast, I think that it's really important to identify your passions, because it's that passion that will keep you moving forward in the hard times. It's really important to try to connect to your tribe, you know, whoever you identify as your tribe, and having those trusting relationships that you can lean on. And then, I don't know, just be brave. You know, just, I know fear will come. There'll be moments where you say, I can't do this, I can't do this, oh, I'm scared. But just try to take that step, be brave, because you don't know where it's going to take you. And most often, you can do great things. You can do greater things than you think.
Thank you so much for sharing that. I appreciate that. One last follow-up question is, I didn't know you were the person who put together the Tools for Women in STEM course. I've seen that around. Are any of those materials online available for people other than MSU? And if not, maybe a hint, nudge, nudge.
Yeah, so the materials are all in D2L. It is sort of an experiential course, so you have to sort of go through it. And I have actually been playing with the idea of perhaps doing this widely, like for anybody that wants to take it, like on Zoom or something. But it's not the sort of course that is just like read this book. It's more of an experiential course. And one of the main benefits, if not the main benefit, is for people to come together and have those conversations with each other. And so that's a little bit harder to do of just putting materials out there. So I don't think it is a course that lends itself to just putting materials out there. I've been actually contacted by a publisher that wanted me to produce a book based on the course, and I have refused to do that because I think that is not the value of the course. The value of the course is, it's the students that tell me this all the time, is it's the interactions, it's those conversations, it's those exercises, it's a lot of active discussion that is taking place in the classroom.
Well, I have a lot of respect for you for saying a publisher contacted you and you said, no, thanks, that doesn't do the job, you know? That's like a lot of integrity. That's cool.
Well, I mean, I would be very happy to write a book. And in fact, I have written an academic book, but I think that it just doesn't lend itself to that format, the type of course that was developed. Just so that you have an idea, it's all based on, how about you watch this TED talk and now you discuss this? How about you think about this topic? What about this case study? Now look at this case study. What would you do? It's a lot of that active thinking and reflecting. And so it's much harder to achieve if you just have like this sort of stagnant book.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it'd be a good idea maybe to put that information out there for like instructors, maybe to take that in other institutions. But yeah, I agree that you can't get that from just reading something.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you so much for all your input, Philomena. It was very interesting.
Well, thank you. Thank you for inviting me. It was really very nice to talk to you.
I hope you enjoyed today's episode. This podcast was created by Brian Stanley and Professor Hui-Win Lin. This episode was hosted by Bill Good and Kinza Hassan, edited by Esther Cohen Lin and Hui-Win Lin. Thanks for listening.